Welcome to Parenting a Child with a Developmental Delay. My name is Sarah Dimmerman, also known as Help Me Sarah, and I'm joined today by Rona Feldstein. And over the next little while, we're going to chat about the issues and details related to parenting a child with a developmental delay. I'd like to begin by asking you, Rona, to tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thanks, Sarah. My name, as Sarah had mentioned, is Rona Feldstein. I'm an occupational therapist who has devoted my career for more than 35 years to the area of pediatrics. I'm also currently the owner and director of York Pediatric Therapy Services in Richmond Hill that was started in 1984.
Well, thanks for being with us, Rona, today. I know that you bring with you a wonderful, like such a solid background in occupational therapy, so you're the perfect person to chat with today. So perhaps I could begin by asking you just a simple question, maybe not so simple, but straightforward maybe. What is a developmental delay? Can you define it in layman's terms for us, perhaps?
Sure. Thanks, Sarah. A developmental delay really is any condition or disorder that interferes with a child's normal developmental progress when compared to other children of the same age. And the delays can be in different areas. These can include physical and motor abilities, speech, vision, hearing, cognitive or intellectual development, as well as emotional development, and even what we would call self-help skills. Skills that children learn to help themselves, so feeding, dressing, things like that.
So,
implications can range from having a very mild delay to a more severe delay.
So I'm thinking, you know, parents will often come to speak to me about, you know, whether their child is developing at the speed that they're supposed to be. And of course, because I'm not trained in this area, I will often refer to people such as yourself. But I've always found, what I've said to parents, you know, with the knowledge that I have, is that sometimes children develop at different speeds to one another. So my kind of rule of thumb, I don't know if you agree with this or not, is that children will develop sometimes at six with a 6 month lag, or a 6 month can be 6 months ahead of children their age. So do you ever speak about that in terms of that 6 month range either side?
I certainly agree with that. I certainly have found that in my career that developmental milestones and what are the expected norms for developmental milestones certainly have changed in the last over 10 years, I would say. And I agree that within, let's say, a 4 to 6 months range is considered normal, and that all children develop at different rates. And I think that that's an important thing to remember.
So I'm thinking that the way that it might, so that a child might first be identified as any kind of red flag might be, and you can tell me, you can add to this for sure, might be if a parent is, for example, going to a play group with children of the same or similar age to their own child, and noticing that maybe a child of their son's age is doing things beyond what their child can do. That might be one way, perhaps, of a parent identifying that their child may be lagging or accelerated. And I'm thinking other ways might be if it's pointed out to them, maybe if they're at a preschool, maybe, and the teachers are noticing, that might be another way. But can you think of any other ways that a parent might be able to identify that their child doesn't seem to be developing when they're supposed to, or within that 4 to 6 month range either way?
Absolutely. One of the things that we do hear from parents that come to us is that they're not developing compared to another child that they've had, whether it's an older child, or they're comparing it to a niece or a nephew. And sometimes they even have, you know, parents or a good friend that may say, you know what, I don't see your child walking with a normal gait, or I notice that your child isn't interacting with the other kids. So sometimes, you know, things happen off the cuff. And as a new parent, you know, you're so excited about you know, ensuring that your child has a normal course, that sometimes, you know, you do miss something. I guess that the other areas that are really important is that if you really see something that doesn't look normal, for instance, if your child, you know, is walking by, you know, 12 to 14 months, but they're limping a little bit, or they're dragging a leg, or, you know, they're not crawling in a normal pattern. Those are certainly red flags that you want to investigate further. And, I mean, we can certainly talk about the different areas of motor development and some of the red flags that parents can be more aware of in order to help identify whether the child is having a difficulty or not.
Have you heard of the books? There's a series of books. I think the author is Louise Bates Ames. She's written a series of books, your one-year-old, your two-year-old, your three-year-old, and she looks at physical, emotional, social development of the average, kind of, as we call, normal child. And so do you find that those kinds of books are books that parents might also find some information in that might be helpful, or are those dangerous?
I think that's a really good resource. I mean, certainly, you know, books that you can find online are good resources. Even Googling normal development, you can come up with some really good websites that provide that kind of information.
Right. Because developmental development is across, it's been through the ages, right? I mean, really, human beings, or has it changed? I think you were mentioning earlier that some of the developmental milestones might have been adjusted over the years.
Yes, I find that because parents are more aware of early stimulation and the importance that has on development, that children are actually reaching some of their milestones earlier than they have in the past.
Right.
I mean, for example, you know, most children, it was said, would walk around 12 months. Well, it's not uncommon now to hear children who are actually walking at 9 months.
And is that because of stimulation? Is that brain stimulation, do you think?
Some of it is brain stimulation. Some of it also has to do with what the kind of development and history of reaching milestones that has happened within the parents and familiarly
right.
within other family members.
Or maybe just evolution.
Possibly.
So do you want to touch on some examples of things that might be some red flags in the different areas of development that you mentioned a little bit earlier on in our conversation?
Sure. And I'm going to touch first on motor skill development, because I think that's what parents look at foremost when
right.
they're observing their children.
Right.
So, you know, there are some particular things, certainly by 7 months.
So sorry, just want to go back for a second. When
sure.
you say motor skill, can you just share what is a motor skill, and is there a difference between, say, I've heard fine motor and gross motor?
Absolutely, okay. And that's what I was just going to talk
okay.
about, is gross motor skills are large motor skills, so sitting, crawling, walking, running are gross motor skills, where mm-hmm. fine motor skills have to deal with the hands, so that are... Those are the kinds of activities that children use when they're feeding themselves, manipulating little objects when they're playing, taking objects to their mouth, putting little pegs and boards and things like that.
Right. Okay, so, sorry, go on in terms of...
Sure. So when we're looking at some of those gross motor skills, certainly by 7 months, if your child has stiff muscles, they're very tight or they're very floppy, and when you pull your child up to sit and their head is, you know, they're not able to control their head in a sitting position, or they're not rolling in either direction. By 1 year, if they're not crawling, they're not pulling themselves up to stand, or they're dragging one side of their body, those are signs that you really want to discuss with your family doctor or your pediatrician. When it comes to fine motor skills, things that are, you know, sort of red flags, that if your child isn't reaching out to touch an object by about 5 months. They're not grabbing at the bottle to help take it to their mouth by, 6 to 9 months. They're not, taking objects to their mouth around 10 months. They're not picking up tiny little objects with their pincer fingers, their index, and their thumb. Again, those are red flags that you might want to discuss.
And I've heard Cheerios are a wonderful way of identifying that.
They're great. The kids love Cheerios. And also, if your child happens to be crawling and they're not picking up little lint on the floor that has been missed, or dog hair, which they tend to do, it embarrass the parent in front of guests, of course.
Yeah.
Those are also red flags.
Right, so they should be picking up the dog hair and the lint off the floor.
Certainly by 10 to 12 months.
So yeah. So just of interest, you're talking about the really early development. Do you ever notice that some of these fine and gross motor skills are pretty normal earlier on and then may change as kids get older? I guess depending on the reason why the delay is happening, right?
Absolutely, and for some children, the parent says, well, he had the skill and then he doesn't have it anymore. Or he's developed that skill, but it's not progressing any further.
Right.
And that happens for different reasons. We've seen children who've come in and unfortunately, they broke their arm. They fell and around 10 months and they broke their arm. And so they just haven't rehabilitated perhaps back to where they were before, or because they've had pain and trauma there, they're a little reluctant to use that particular limb, and therefore, it's not developing the way that they should.
Right. And that would be a good reason maybe to work with an occupational therapist to figure out, is it just a delay because of that or what else might be happening?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And one of the other things with fine motor delays, and certainly this happens culturally, is that, it's quite normal for the brain to show a preference for a fine motor skill quite early on. So parents will notice that a child might be more predominant in using their right hand for things,
right,
as well as left hand. But in some cultures, even though a child may want to use their left hand, parents are switching them to be right-handed, and that can slow down some of the development of the fine motor skill.
Is that generally not advised?
No. If a child is left-handed, they're left-handed.
Yeah.
And culturally, certainly within the North American societies, we just let the child develop as they want.
As their brain dictates.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
As their brain dictates. And, unfortunately, if a child were in a traumatic accident and they needed to be changed to use another hand, that's a different thing. But
right,
the brain does not completely lateralize for a specific hand in girls until about 9 to 10 years, but certainly later in boys, often not till 12 to 14 years of age.
What do you mean by lateralize?
Often we show a preference for one specific hand, but the brain pattern that maintains that preference is what we call lateralization.
That's interesting. I didn't realize it was that late.
Yes.
So
that's why often it's easy to change a child from one hand to the other, because those specific patterns haven't cemented into the brain until then.
And I've heard wonderful, wonderful characteristics associated with left-handed people anyway. So,
my husband and daughter who are left-handed tell me that all the time.
But I've heard it's true. So that's the fine and gross motor. Was anything else you wanted to say about that, or do you want to talk about some of the other delays that you've identified or that parents may identify?
I think those are some of the important things.
Okay.
I think that certainly some of the other issues.
Okay.
One of the things that I do find that parents do have some concerns around are vision and hearing.
Okay.
And certainly if you find that, your child is not following an object when they're about 4 months, if they're not noticing their hands and looking to play with their hands by about 5 months, if one of the eyes is turning in or out.
Right.
If they're not following your gaze when you talk to them and smiling back at you, those are concerns that, you know, you would want to discuss with your doctor and possibly referral to an ophthalmologist.
Right. And I think the smiling kids, babies don't usually smile until, what is it, 3 months?
Yes.
Yeah. So, because you're talking about 4 months anyway, right? You're talking about at 4 months that should be in place.
Absolutely. And we're talking about the window of you know, what is in the range of normal. So.
And I guess, too, you know, maybe this would be a good time to emphasize that, you know, regular pediatric or medical visits are so essential after birth and continuing right through. I know that I take my kids to the doctor every year, come what may, for their physicals. I think that's such an important way of also establishing proper milestones, because your doctor will ask you questions to make sure that your child is reaching the milestones that he or she should.
I can't emphasize that enough. And I know that parents have, you know, come and discussed with us, well, I told my doctor, but he said they'll grow out of it.
Right.
And I think that, you know, there is some validity in that, and it depends about what you're talking about. But certainly, you know, as we talked about in motor skills, if your child, you know, is dragging a leg, and if, you know, they're not pushing up to stand, and they seem rather weak in comparison to other children, and your doctor's saying, well, they'll grow out of that, I would ask your doctor for a second opinion.
Yeah, you always trust, always err on the side of caution. Don't just go with that, because doctors are human too.
Well, that and the fact that you're with your child all the time.
Right.
And as a parent, you know your child, and you begin to develop a sixth sense.
Right.
About their personality and about, you know, how they are working in different environments and so on. When you go to the doctor, they're only seeing them for 15, 20 minutes.
Right.
So I think that, you know, as parents, they are wonderful observers. And, you know, I've said to parents, I believe you, and because they're with their children all the time, and perhaps some doctors don't give enough credence to parents' concerns and tell them that they're being overly concerned or overly bearing, but I think it's really important to listen to a parent when they have a concern.
Does a parent, by the way, need a referral to an occupational therapist such as yourself through a doctor, or can they self-refer?
Parents can absolutely self-refer if they do have occupational therapy as one of their extended health care benefits. Then often the extended health care provider or the insurance company wants to see a letter from a doctor referring the child to an occupational or physiotherapist,
right,
or even speech pathologist if that coverage is being paid for by an insurer.
Okay, so let's move on to some of the, so you talked about fine and gross motor, and you talked about eyes, vision. You were going to mention something about hearing, I think.
Yes, and I, you know, hearing often is something that, you know, parents aren't as aware of with regards to how well the child may be hearing, but I think it's really important in that it also relates to speech. So if your child isn't turning their head to, you know, bells or to your voice, certainly by about, you know, 3 to 4 months,
right,
you really want to make sure that they are hearing well. Certainly by 6 months, if they're not responding to sounds, if they're not trying to copy some of the sounds that you're saying, like ba-ba-ba, ma-ma-ma-ma, da-da-da, if your child isn't babbling by about, you know, 7 to 8 months, you want to, you know, certainly go and speak to your pediatrician. Certainly by 2 years, your child should be speaking in at least 10 to 15 words. And if they're not communicating and seem frustrated in being able to communicate, those are red flags that you certainly want to investigate further.
Right, because if they're not hearing, then they can't hear the sounds that they need to formulate their own speech.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, so that's the hearing, vision, fine and gross motor. Was there anything else that you wanted to talk about in terms of developmental growth?
I mean, I think the area of sensory perception, and what I mean by sensory perception is that children, you know, learn through different kinds of senses. So there's hearing, there's vision, There is taste.
Right.
There's also what we call movement. So things that give us balance and challenge our balance. Things that give us touch. So related to touch and temperature and pain and having a sense of, you know, how we move our bodies through space are really important. So if a child doesn't like to cuddle as an infant, if a child overreacts to being touched on their hands or around their face.
What about, I hear a lot from parents about their kids not liking the feel of certain clothing.
Exactly. They may not like the texture. They complain about labels in the back of their clothing, or they're always taking off their socks and shoes and wanting to go barefoot.
Right.
For other kids, they may cut themselves, and they may not even realize that they've been bleeding.
Right.
Is also a big concern. So there's ways of looking at your child. Do they overreact to being touched and complain? I mean, I've even had kids who, when you open up the container of Play-Doh, they actually gag or vomit at the smell of it.
Wow.
There are children who may refuse to eat certain textures. They gag at soft textures, or they're storing food in their mouth because they don't get a sense of how much food is in their mouth.
Mm.
Or they may even play, let's say they're 2 years old, when children begin to play with one another, at least interact. And they're always on the sidelines. They're afraid to almost play in a group. They tend to sit on the sidelines and observe more than they interact with other kids. Or they're refusing to do, you know, get their hands dirty in pudding. Or if they get their hands dirty during a mealtime, they're crying or complaining or crying because they don't like the touch. Or they don't want to be washed in the bath by using a washcloth.
What about kids who cry very easily, that are very emotionally fragile?
You know, that could be a sensory thing. Some children get really overwhelmed by a lot of what we call multi-sensory stimulation. So they're fine when they're at home, but the minute you take them into a mall or they go into a play group or a family gathering, they start to cry and you have to remove them. And once you take them out of that situation, they begin to calm down. That's a sign of being overwhelmed by a lot of different kinds of stimulation.
So how does that tie in with occupational therapy, and like what are the concerns, or what is the delay or the weakness? I don't know how you describe it. Like, how would you even work with somebody like that, or a child like that?
Well, certainly we can assess children like that, more so in our clinic, where we have different situations that we can pose, so we can see how a child would interact with different kinds of sensory, you know, information.
So, I guess what I'm trying to ask is, so if you've identified, say, you know, the child who shows an extreme dislike for maybe getting his or her hands dirty, then what would you actually be looking at? Like, what would you be diagnosing that child with if you identified that as being, like, what would you then be working on?
We would be looking to work on different kinds of sensory stimulation and possibly look at why this child may be having what we would call a sensory processing disorder.
Okay.
Or sensory integration dysfunction.
Okay, and then you would be able to use certain techniques that would actually help to do what?
To try and, for lack of a better word, normalize the sensory nervous system.
Right.
In allowing information to come in.
Right.
And to deal with the information. We learn through all different senses, and we interact with different senses within our environment on a constant basis.
Right.
So whether I'm talking to you and I'm looking at you, I'm listening to your voice, there may be a fan going in the back of the environment, but I've learned that I can tune some senses out
right.
that aren't important and to work on things that are more important for me to deal with. So the fact that there's a light buzzing in the background, but I can still put that aside and listen to your conversation is an example of how the sensory nervous system can block some non-important information out, but yet take more important information to deal with at the specific time. And sometimes the central nervous system has difficulty doing that. So it has a problem with blocking out some information and dealing with others, and so it deals with everything all at once.
Yeah.
And
like, so this is an example.
Get overloaded and crying, screaming, falling asleep, or needing to be removed from the environment is one way of the central nervous system coping with the overload.
Huh. I think a lot of parents may be quite relieved to hear that their children may be able to be helped by occupational therapy or through certain treatment procedures, because, you know, I think a lot of parents experience this with their children. And I guess we're not talking about the average picky eater here, right? We're talking about children who show extreme, as you said, extreme behaviors towards food, for example.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there are many children who, you know, are picky eaters. They don't like a certain, you know, taste or a texture, but they're still able to eat enough food to be healthy.
Right.
When a child starts restricting the amount of food to perhaps only certain kinds of foods, and I'm going to give a rather extreme example, but I recently worked with a young boy who was 10 years old, and he was still eating baby food.
Wow.
Because he just couldn't handle the texture of many other foods. And it was socially interfering.
Of course.
Because he couldn't go to birthday parties.
Yeah.
Going on school trips was a real issue.
Right.
He couldn't go over to a friend's house.
Yeah.
Because he basically was eating baby food, Cheerios.
Yeah.
And a peanut butter sandwich.
Wow.
And, you know, peanut butter is such a no-no now in children's culture.
Right.
Because of allergies, that he was so restricted.
Yeah.
And in working with him, found out that he really had poor, what we call, oral motor coordination. So he had a lot of difficulty with breathing and sucking and swallowing and coordinating the movements within his mouth, that taking in baby food and just swallowing was the most that he could manage. But after working with this young man and finding out what were his goals, and I think that's really an important thing to stress, is that for some children who have some developmental delays, and not all children are delayed in every single area,
right,
that you need to get their cooperation and get them to be able to understand why they need to come to therapy.
Right.
And for this little boy, he was able to express that he just wanted to have a friend come over to play and stay for dinner.
That's yeah.
school at 10.
Yeah.
And so we worked through that, and it took a while, but after about 7 months, he, within the food groups that we were able to get him to eat with, he was able to put together a menu of having French fries, hot dog, and celery
wow.
and carrot sticks.
Wow.
As something that, you know, he wanted to have a friend come over and eat, and we were able to do that for him. It was just such a rewarding
I'm experience sure.
For the family and myself.
For sure.
But we also just have worked with a little boy who at 9 months came in and basically was refusing any kind of soft food. In 9 months, typically you're giving your child junior foods and you know, getting them to drink from a cup and so on, and he just refused any kind of jar food at all. And in observing him, I found that he was really defensive to being touched around his mouth.
Really?
And didn't like his hands touched, which is a huge component to eating.
Of so course.
Eat with their hands.
Yeah.
They want to put their hands on the food. They want to hold their fork or their spoon, and they want to hold the bottle. And, you know, parents are feeding them, so they're coming to the face. And he just couldn't handle that. So we actually had to work on his comfort with being touched and move on to there. And once we realized that soft textures were not something he could handle, we moved on to more solid things. And within literally 5 therapy sessions, I just discharged this little boy, I'd say 2 weeks ago. And so he's now almost 11 months.
Yeah.
He's now eating 30 different kinds of food.
Wow, that's incredible. Those are really great stories to share. So you talk about this 9-month-old and any kind of, I think you and I both believe that early intervention is really important. Like the sooner you can intervene and get the child help, the better. Just in terms of, I mean, when children are sent to you through somebody like myself or through the pediatrician, then you would, I presume, conduct some kind of an assessment?
Absolutely. Sometimes it depends on the age of the child, but we're always going to look at the total development of the child. We're not just going to hone in. Let's say the mom comes in and says, well, you know, I'm worried about his fine motor skills.
Right.
We're going to look at the total child.
Right.
Because fine motor skills are often, you know, one specific area that may be weak, but we need to have good muscle tone. We need to have good trunk tone, good vision, and so on in order to have good fine motor skills. So we're going to look at all areas of the child's development and to assess them, most often using some standardized assessments, which will help dictate where their development in different areas is in relation to the norm for children their age.
So I guess there are a lot of checklists, I would imagine.
There are some checklists, but the occupational therapist or the physiotherapist or the speech therapist is going to actually work with that child. Some of it may be checklists,
right,
but some of it may be actual examination, so looking at the muscle tone and testing the muscle tone.
Right.
Looking at protective reactions that a child may or may not be exhibiting, whether they're equal on the right and the left side. And also engaging the child in play activities to see how they actually perform those skills that are appropriate for that age. So it's a combination of both.
So within your clinic, for example, do you have strictly occupational therapists, or do you have other people with other, you know, with other forms of discipline like speech and language pathologists?
We have occupational physio and speech therapists on site.
Okay, so you're looking at it kind of from a team approach in some way.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And so I know that, you know, it'd be difficult to define or to describe the treatment process, because I would imagine it would be different for every child. But is there anything that parents should be looking for when they're looking for treatment, like in terms of, you know, to making sure that, you know, that they're in a reputable clinic? Like, how would you identify what a reputable clinic is in terms of length of treatment or kinds of treatments that they should be looking for?
Sure. I mean, different clinics have different approaches. I really think that it's important that your concerns, your specific concerns, are being addressed. You want to certainly make sure that the clinic hires registered therapists. Occupational physio and speech therapists are all regulated healthcare professions, so therapists need to be registered with their professional college in order to service whatever population they're working with,
right,
whether it's adults or children.
Right.
So you want to make sure that therapists are registered. You also want to make sure that when you're talking with the therapist, that they're, for lack of a better situation, is selling you a package. Because every child is different. So you really want to make sure that the therapist is listening to your specific needs and concerns, that they are not over-assessing, and that can happen sometimes too.
What do you mean by over-assessing?
In other words, when you come in, they're going to give you a package. Well, you know, you're going to see the speech, and you're going to see the physio, and you're going to see the OT. that to me can be an overkill for assessment.
Right.
If your child is coming in and there are specific speech and language issues, then you should see the speech and language therapist.
Right.
And let her decide whether there needs to be further assessment for physio and occupational therapy.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
As well as, you know, if you're coming in because your child has a general, muscle tone issue and they're not doing their fine and gross motor skills the way they should, then you want to see an occupational therapist who then may say, you know what, I think we need to see the physiotherapist for more in-depth assessment with regards to why your child is, you know, not using their left leg or why they're walking up on their toes on their left leg.
Sorry, what's the difference between, what different services would an OT, an occupational therapist, and a physiotherapist provide?
Good question, and one that is often posed to us. In some, I think that sometimes differs on the different facility, but the occupational therapist is really engaged in looking at the whole person,
okay.
as a physiotherapist might. But a physiotherapist is going to look at muscle tone, looking at muscle strength, and more specifically, motor skills and patterns. It's not to say that a physiotherapist is not going to look at the total child, even though they may be more specifically looking at their motor skills. However, an occupational therapist is really going to look at the whole person. So she's going to look at how a child performs their gross and fine motor skills for that particular age group. She's going to look at their self-help skills, their dressing, their feeding, their ability to deal with different kinds of sensory issues. She's also going to look at their social skills, their social interactions, and so on. So although all practices, speech, physio, and occupational therapy, are what we call client-centered, so you're really looking at, you know, what that particular person is doing within the appropriate skills for their age, the occupational therapist tends to look at all the different areas that a child is functioning in and can work with gross motor skills. But if she feels that, it's more just within, you know, general play and ability to improve some of their muscle tone or muscle weakness, and it can be done within the context of working with a child's gross motor skills, she may not refer to a physiotherapist, where if there are more specific issues, she will refer to that physiotherapist to do more in-depth work and use more skill training in that specific area.
Okay, great. So I'm just thinking, you know, I know what it's like when parents come to talk to me after they've received a diagnosis, whether it be, you know, a diagnosis of a delay, a developmental delay, or whether it be a learning disability or anything like that. And I know, especially having worked with families from different parts of the world, that especially within certain cultures, there's even more shame and embarrassment. Parents don't want to even sometimes share the diagnosis with school personnel, whereas it may actually be quite important to do so for the child. So I know that I've dealt with that certainly within my practice in terms of helping parents overcome that those feelings, and even feelings around maybe guilt, thinking that they've had a, you know, played a role in making this happen. I'm sure you've had some experience of that yourself.
Very, very similar experiences. And one of the things that is often difficult in some cultures is just getting the parent to even see a specialist for a diagnosis or to be directed to a healthcare professional that can help in the assessment of that person. In some cultures, it's, you know, much more shameful to have a boy have a disability. And in general, for whatever reason, we do, and I think I can say this for other occupational therapists as well, that we tend to see more boys than we do see girls. And for some cultures, it is, because the boy is, you know, is more the preferred gender.
Right.
And so to have a male child have something wrong is really shameful. And, you know, we do a lot of education, and I can't stress this enough, is that, you know, when you're dealing with a parent that has a child that has some delay, and I think maybe we also need to clarify developmental delay, in that a developmental delay does not have to be what we call a global developmental delay, in that it doesn't always affect the whole child.
Right.
It may affect just specific areas of development. And really educating people that, you know, it's not their fault. Things happen without any understanding for whatever reason.
Yeah.
In some cases, there are specific reasons, in that the child was, you know, very premature, and now children are, you know, being born and surviving at, you know, 25, 28 weeks gestation, which was unheard of.
Right.
But that also comes with, you know, some issues later on. And so, you know, we need to educate parents and say, you know, it's not always your fault, and there are different reasons why this happened. Some are explained, some are not explained. But in all of that, what you need to do is to work towards the betterment of your child's progress.
So to try not to focus as much on the cause as much as the treatment and how to help your child.
Exactly. If there was a reason, I mean, we have many children now who are being adopted from other countries.
Right.
They've been in institutions and have not had, you know, good early stimulation.
Right.
And, you know, parents are thankfully, you know, adopting these children and giving them a much better life. But some of these kids do come with some issues. And, you know, a parent can't feel guilty for that. And they need to be applauded, in my mind, for, you know, adopting these wonderful children and giving them a better life and being able to, you know, want to learn how to make their development and their lives so much more rewarding.
On the other hand, I guess there are some things that would be helpful for parents to know in terms of, you know, early stimulation and just, you know, early stimulation and proper nutrition and that kind of thing that could also affect some development, correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And so I think it's helpful for parents to pay attention to that, but not to feel terribly guilty if they've done whatever they, you know, they've worked their hardest at being aware of what was good and what to do during those early months, especially in terms of making sure that your child, you know, and I think that, you know, some parents almost go overboard sometimes, I find, and want, you know, the little Einstein videos and stuff like that, you know, where parents want to even boost their children. Nothing wrong with that some of the time, but I guess my personal feeling is that you don't want to overstimulate your child either, correct?
Absolutely. And you know, putting a child in front of a TV with a video is one kind of stimulation, but it also is isolated stimulation.
Right.
And in my mind, you know, the best way to stimulate your child, and I'm not just talking at the infancy stage, I'm talking toddler and even well into elementary, is to interact with your child, is to provide them with different kinds of environmental situations that they need to deal with, because, you know, children need to develop and interact with all different kinds of people,
right.
All different kinds of situations, and, you know, not allowing them to get dirty is a way of, you know, perhaps isolating them from different kinds of stimulation. Mm-hmm. And we need to just, you know, be playful, be mindful. It's easy to be very frustrated as a parent when you're trying to stimulate your child and they don't react and they don't seem to catch on as fast as perhaps other children, and makes the child more stressed and reluctant to work in a specific environment or to interact with you as a person or to play with certain toys, because they're going to relate that kind of relationship to a specific toy or environment and not want to do that. So I think that there's just so many kinds of stimulation, and there's so many resources out in the community, as well as, you know, books to read and so on. But just to get back to what you're saying, yeah, you know, a child can be overstimulated with giving them too much.
Yeah, would that be one of the don'ts, maybe?
Yeah, I think one of the don'ts is, you know, look at how long you play with a child in relation to their age. So I find that, you know, for an infant, you know, more than about 5 minutes can be too much.
Right. To take breaks.
Over and over. So you need to change things up, and you need to take your cues from the child.
Right.
Some parents want to read to their child ad nauseum.
Right.
And, you know, it's inappropriate to expect a 2-year-old to be listening to chapter books.
Yeah.
They need to be looking at single picture and ask them, what's this? And have them point to things and do that for maybe 5 minutes.
Again.
And do a motor skill. So look at your child's behavior. If they're becoming restless, if you know, no, mommy, no, I don't want to do that. You know, take your cues and say, well, why isn't he wanting to do that? You know, have I been too forceful? Or is this a sign that, you know, this is a skill that's too hard for him?
So, could even be in the case of homework. Sometimes I find kids need to just walk away for a period of time to take a break and then come back to it.
Exactly. And often, you know, sitting down for some children, especially if they have some attentional issues, so let's sit down and do homework, to them means the whole evening. So sometimes using a timer and say, we're just going to sit down and work on our homework for 15 minutes. When the buzzer goes off, you can go and play for a little while, and then you're going to come back.
Right.
And then they're able to focus and be more productive within that amount of time.
Were there any other things that you could think of that would be, you know, do's and don'ts for parents?
I think that as far as don'ts, is that if you see a child is really refusing to do a particular activity, or is refusing to interact with a specific person or play in a specific environment, you need to look into that further.
Right.
If it's a specific person, you need to be able to hopefully sit down and speak with that child and say, you know, what is it about that person that you don't like?
Right.
And there's all kinds of reasons that we can think of that would make a child uncomfortable. Or if you see your child, you know, not wanting to go into malls and situations, or transition to, you know, to new environments. Every time you go to a new place, they get really anxious. You know, don't force them, but try and prepare them, things like that.
Right.
As far as do, I mean, be playful with your child. Give them lots of hugs. Play with a variety of different kinds of materials. You can, you know, do lots of things with regards to sensory things. You can play in sand. You can play with pudding. You can be dancing to different music. All different kinds of motor games, row your boat, singing, things like that. And really,
are you when we're talking the do's and don'ts, are you talking about how to stimulate, some do's for stimulating, so that children are in a healthy development, like going through healthy development? Is that what
absolutely.
You're
absolutely okay. I mean, all those kinds of things are healthy, but even if you see that your child may be having an issue, still use those kinds of general stimulating activities, but perhaps keep a log of what is it that your child doesn't seem to be developing well in.
Right.
So if you're going to do row, row your boat, and he doesn't want you to hold his hand, or you find that when you're doing row, row your boat, one side of the body feels weaker than the other, jot it down.
Yeah.
If you see that your child isn't, you know, answering your questions or singing with you, jot it down. I mean, as a parent, we observe our children constantly, but sometimes we forget. So keeping a log and noting specific concerns will be really helpful when you go back to your doctor and say, these are the areas that I have concerns on with. And there are lots of resources out there. There are, you know, luckily in Ontario, we have things called early years, which are sites that are set up by the Ministry of Community and Social Services, where parents can go and get material about development, and they have little play groups where they can learn about what is appropriate for their child and become educated on, you know, how to do certain things, and even to speak to a person, a professional who's at these centers, often early childhood educators, that could answer some of your simple questions and perhaps direct you to specific resources.
I was also thinking, when I was talking about books earlier, I forgot to also mention those great books, the What to Expect books as well. Like, there's the What to Expect When You're Expecting, and the What to Expect Your First Year, What to Expect the Toddler Years. Those are all I found very easy to look through, and they're organized in a really, you know, good in a great fashion for parents to be able to locate information easily.
Yeah, those are wonderful resources and readily available to parents. There's also some, you know, really good books on, you know, normal development. Too many to mention, but yeah, if you're going into, you know, a Chapters or Indigo, or even going on Amazon, they have tons and tons of books.
Yeah.
And even if you have some concerns around some of the sensory issues that we talked about, there's a book called The Out of Sync Child.
Oh, yeah.
Carol Stock Kranowitz.
Yeah.
Helps parents to identify some areas of sensory development that that, you know, may be of concern, and to guide a parent as to where to go.
Do you ever advocate on behalf of parents, like in the schools or daycare?
Absolutely, we do. Once we've assessed the child, we will gladly sit down with the school or the daycare center, help create some accommodations within the structure of that environment to best help a child. So, just for example, if a child has difficulty sitting in circle time, sometimes they're better sitting on their own piece of rug that identifies their own personal space if they don't like being with other children.
Right.
We may suggest that they sit closer to the teacher because it makes them feel a little bit more secure. Or we may suggest that they use a specific pencil grip on their pencil to help promote a better, mature pencil grip, whether they're in a daycare center or they're in school. Or we might suggest that after a child's been sitting and working at tabletop activities, that they be given a specific motor activity to do, whether it's collect garbage or to hand out papers to the rest of the class, because it allows them to have a movement activity and to readjust their attention. Or, you know, we may even suggest that they sit on a specific cushion that's filled with air, because it gives their body a chance to move on the chair, and they don't look quite as restless, but they're getting a lot of information into their muscles to work harder with gravity. So absolutely. And every child that comes to see us, after we've, you know, worked and done the assessment, we share the results with the parent. Certainly we'll share those results with any person they give us consent to. And we always create a home program that parents can work at home.
Yeah, that's great.
In relation to perhaps if they need therapy, to supplement what might happen in therapy, as well as provide, as we already suggested, ways to integrate some of those therapeutic techniques within the home, the school, daycare, whatever.
So,
Give parents lots of resources that they can be using and finding within their own community.
That's great. You've been such a wealth of information, Rona. If people wanted to contact you directly, can you just give us your phone number again?
Absolutely. We're located in Richmond Hill, Ontario. Our phone number is 905-737-9680. And we also have a website, www.yorkpediatrics, YorkPaediatrics.com.
And that information will also be posted on my website, you know, a little bit more about you and your center and ways to contact you too. So thank you so much, Rona, and thanks to you for listening to this podcast. We hope that you found the information and the show informative. And for more information about us and to learn more about other free seminars that I'm hosting, visit helpmesara.com. Please subscribe and rate us on iTunes by searching for Help Me Sara. And Sara is spelled S-A-R-A, no H. You can also send your questions, comments, and suggestions for future podcasts by emailing me at podcast@helpmesara.com, by tweeting me at Help Me Sara, or if you're in the Toronto area, by calling me at 905-882-7690. Until next time.